This is Yehudah HaKohen, Vision Movement, Vision Magazine, and you are listening to the Next Stage Podcast. This coming Sunday night will be Rosh Chodesh Adar Bet, the first night of the second month of Adar. This year we have two Adars on our calendar. It's a leap year. And the first of Adar marks the Yahrzeit, the anniversary of the death of Nathaniel and Mor. Nathaniel and Mor was the political leader of the Lehi, the Lochamei Chirut Yisrael, the fighters for the freedom of Israel. He had an interesting political trajectory following our struggle for freedom, following the attainment of political independence. And at the Vision Movement, we study Yelen Mor's ideas and his life's work, largely because we think that there's a lot of value in really mining his thoughts and his work and applying many of his ideas to the contemporary context of Israeli society, our place in West Asia, in the Semitic region, and our relationship with the Palestinians within our country, with the broader region, and with the international community more broadly. And this year, I've invited onto the show one of our activists who is currently in the army, so he's going to be anonymous. It's actually very fitting for a show exploring the thoughts and legacy of Nathaniel and Mor for us to identify our guest as the anonymous soldier. He's anonymous because he's a soldier, and soldiers in our army are generally discouraged from coming on podcasts and speaking about political issues. So we're going to refer to our guest as the anonymous soldier, and I would like to welcome our anonymous soldier to the show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rabbi. Great to be on the show.
All right. So coming up next Sunday night, Monday, is the Yahrzeit of Nathaniel and Mor. We've spoken a lot about his legacy at the Vision Movement. We have many articles and podcasts about his legacy and really trying to apply some of his ideas to today. But right now, I'd like to really focus in on two issues. The first is this idea of political intelligence, because it's something that I deeply believe the national camp is missing right now, especially the national religious camp in Israeli society. And the second issue, which is something I know that you're very interested in talking about, is concepts of freedom.
Right. We're in a situation now that requires a lot of political intelligence because we're fighting a war while at the same time being heavily dependent on a country, being the US, that has interests that are not our interests. And we're fighting a war with their weapons, dependent on their weapons, dependent on their diplomatic protection, and to a certain degree, still dependent on their economic ties, but at the same time, not having the same end goal, not having the same view on what the day after should be with this power that we're so dependent on. It's a very delicate situation that requires a Nathaniel and Mor level of political intelligence. And whether or not we have that right now in our leadership is a big, unfortunately, a big question mark.
Yeah, I think if we're already talking about Nathaniel and Mor, it might be a good idea to rewind slightly further to his leader and teacher, Avraham Stern, Yair. Because I think when we talk about political intelligence in the national camp, it's actually very fitting. I have an article about this. It was originally published in the Jerusalem Post, but later at Vision, about the tragic legacy of David Raziel. David Raziel was a student of Rav Kook. He was a chevruta of Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook. He was the commander of the Etzel, the Irgun Tzvai Leumi, in the late 1930s and very early 1940s. And he's very much the prototype for today's national religious soldier, like the kind of guys coming out of pre-army prep schools like Eli and Atzmona, soldiers with a lot of deep ideology, with a lot of Mesirat Nefesh, a lot of self-sacrifice, a lot of heroism. Some of our most courageous soldiers, some of our greatest warriors, but there's also that lack of political intelligence. And I think that the relationship and the story of Yair and David Raziel is worth exploring here, because Yair, Avraham Stern, his background was actually in I guess for lack of a better word, Bolshevism. Like his background, he was at the time of the Russian Revolution, Yair lived with his Bolshevik uncle in Petrograd. He himself was a member, Yair himself was a member of a Leninist youth movement. That's where his political training, I think, really came from, his understanding, his ability to analyze the political situation and understand what was taking place. And then, of course, as a Jew who felt oppressed in that part of the world, he also identified as a Zionist. He joined Hashomer HaTzair, which ostensibly appeared to kind of merge, to synthesize Jewish nationalism with, of course, Jewish nationalism as an oppressed people's nationalism with class consciousness and the revolutionary struggle. Of course, when Yair made Aliyah, he was very quickly disillusioned with labor Zionism because they weren't the Bolsheviks, meaning I think Yair and some of the other people who shared his political trajectory, they were expecting Katz Nelson and Ben Gurion and kind of like the labor Zionist leaders to launch a Bolshevik-style revolution against the British to free our country and also against Weizmann and the World Zionist Organization. And when they saw that the labor Zionists were not going to do that, many of them, especially Yair, moved over to the revisionist Zionist camp, which didn't have much class consciousness or revolutionary theory.
Quite the opposite.
Right. It was really permeated with liberal ideology, but it was a more muscular form of Zionism, a much more muscular form of Jewish nationalism. But also Jabotinsky disappointed Yair. And so he pretty much gave up on politics. You know, Yair went back to academia, and it was at the Hebrew University that he met David Raziel. And even though Yair had been disillusioned with Zionist politics and was no longer inspired by any of the Zionist ideologies out there, when he heard the Torah, when he learned the Torah of Rav Kook from Raziel, he was immediately inspired to return to political life. And what he essentially did was he took his Leninist political education and combined that with the Torah of Rav Kook, and it, not necessarily at the practical ritual observance level, but the ideological level, meaning the way Rav Kook and, of course, the Rav students understand the purpose of Israel, the mission of Israel, our goals, our aspirations, our destiny, meaning all of that was combined, synthesized by Yair with this very sophisticated Leninist understanding of politics. And that was basically what Sternism was. And Yellen Moore was very much a Sternist in that sense. And Raziel, unfortunately, even though he had the ideology probably on a very, on a much deeper level than Yair and on a much broader level than Yair, meaning he really sat at Merkaz HaRav, he learned from Rav Kook, he learned with Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he was definitely more deeply entrenched in those teachings. He was even teaching, actually. From what I understand, Raziel was even teaching at Merkaz. There's a story that when David Raziel would teach a shiur to women, he would look at the radiator the whole time. He wouldn't look at the women. So he was clearly teaching in some capacity, if stories like that exist. But Raziel lacked the political intelligence and the political education that Yair came with. And therefore, Raziel accepted Jabotinsky's leadership, and also agreed to a ceasefire against the British during World War II, even to the extent that there was a time when the Etzel was helping the British hunt down Yair's followers in what became known as the Lehi in the Stern group.
There's definitely a very clear parallel between the Stern group split in 1939 and what's going on now, where what happened was after the white paper in 1939, which restricted Jewish immigration only almost to zero, barred Jews from buying land and many other very oppressive acts against Jews on the heels of the Arab revolt from 36 until 39. Finally, Stern was able to do a revolt against the British. And they even had contacts in the Polish government, agreements with the Polish government in the summer of 1939, that the Polish government would send the Lehi, would send the Irgun arms, would send them training, and would send Jews from Poland to Israel to fight the British. And then, of course, in September of 1939, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union invaded Poland and started World War II. And Razael, who was with Jabotinsky, called off the revolution, which had not yet started, was still in the planning stages. This greatly frustrated Stern, and Stern left because he wanted to continue the revolution that had been planned and that Jabotinsky had called off. And the criticism of Stern and the criticism of Stern from 1939 until today that you still hear is, how could you possibly be fighting the British, picking this scab with the British while the war against the Nazis was going on? How could you possibly do that? And it's the same criticism that you hear against people like us that are calling into question our relationship with the US. How could you be picking this scab with the US while we're fighting Hamas today, which some people would call the Nazis of today? Whether or not that's true from a scientific view of history is a discussion in and of itself. But how could you possibly pick the scab at a time like this? And I think in truth, this is exactly the time to pick a scab like this, because the Irgun would eventually come around, that you need to fight the British. They would come around in 1944 when Begin took over the organization. But those 5 years that they waffled about from 39 until 1944 were pretty consequential years for the Jewish people. And one could only think how things could have gone differently if the Irgun had had a little bit more political intelligence, not sent their best men to die for the British Empire in Iraq, like David Raziel would eventually, unfortunately, do, but had been fighting for the Jewish people and the Jewish mission and Jewish survival and Jewish life instead.
Right. Yes, it's very telling that David Raziel, who is known in the underground, by the way, as Ben Hananel. His name in the underground was Ben Hananel, to the point that the derogatory term of Lehi for Etzel members at that time period was Bachnikim, like Bachnikim being like Ben Hananel, Nikim, right? So yeah, it's very telling, as you said, that he fell on foreign soil wearing a British uniform, which is an expression of his lack of political intelligence. Again, despite his Mesirut Nefesh, despite his Torah, despite his deep Jewish national consciousness, he just didn't understand what to do with all that. And I think that it really brings us to the criticism we can make of the national religious camp in Israeli society today. This is a camp with a lot of idealistic youth, a lot of very strong ideology, especially in comparison to other sectors of Israeli society today, and a lot of self-sacrifice, a lot of Mesirut Nefesh. Many of our best combat officers, especially the lower level combat officers, are coming from the National Religious Camp. And these are people who really dedicate their lives to participating in Jewish history and advancing Jewish interests, and making sure that we hold on to Judea and Samaria. But there doesn't seem to be much political intelligence, meaning the National Religious Camp can bring 200,000 to 300,000 people to a demonstration, but they don't know what they're doing at that demonstration, and they don't know what they're doing with those people, as opposed to, let's say, somebody like Ehud Barak on the other side, who's trying to advance Western interests in our country. He and his people are able to orchestrate weekly demonstrations that are constantly escalating and putting pressure exactly where they want to put pressure in order to advance their agenda and achieve their aims. That's something the National Religious Camp does not know how to do. And I think it was you who showed me a quote recently from our Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
The national religious has a big heart and a small brain. If you remember, that was a quote that got leaked after the 2021 election, which was the election that eventually gave way to the Bennett-Lapid government. When Bibi was negotiating with Bennett, Bibi said this, and Bennett and his team leaked it. And as someone that comes from that sector and identifies with that sector, as I'm sure you do as well, it hurt to hear the prime minister of the country say that about your sector. But when you look at history, and specifically Bibi's history, and specifically his first term as prime minister, which ended with the splitting of the National Religious Party, half of the party leaving his government, causing early elections, which eventually Bibi would lose and give way to the disastrous, incredibly disastrous, and I say this now with Hezbollah right on our northern border, that level of disastrous Barak government, it's easy to see why Bibi would say something like that. because not only in 1998, 1999, have the national religious, have our sector put ideological purism above the pragmatic action that someone like Netanyahu and Moore valued so much, in a way that really, really cost Israel big time. And it's something that we as a sector, and we as a whole country, frankly, need to take a hard look at ourselves and say, what are we doing and where are we going? Because we're in a complicated situation. We're in a very complicated situation where we're fighting a war with something like 80, 90% of the weapons we're using to fight the war, and the diplomatic protection we're using to fight the war is being supplied by a country that does not share our end goal. That is a spiderweb tangled situation that takes a level of political intelligence that pure ideological zealousness is just not going to be enough.
Right, and Bennett is a perfect example of this, meaning Bennett is not even as provincial as someone like Bezalel Smotrich or many of the national religious voting public, meaning Bennett is somebody who lived abroad for some time, was involved in business ventures, understands the world outside our borders a little bit better than some of the other national religious politicians. But I think that as prime minister, he clearly showed that he lacked political intelligence, and he made moves that he might have seen as benefiting in the short term, but were not good for his career, were not good for his credibility with his voters, and was not good for the nation. And I think that what Bibi might have been speaking about Naftali Bennett when he made that quote, when he made that statement, but in reality, I think it applies perhaps even stronger in relation to somebody like Smotrich and the broader national religious public, because there's a level of provinciality that is much, much stronger with that. And again, I live amongst these guys. These are some of the best people. I'm a fan of the camp. I'm part of the camp. I send my children to those schools. I teach in those schools myself. But it's very clear that what's lacking is political intelligence. And you could see it, by the way, if you look at I think a good example of this, you know, one of the leaders Israel had, and this is relevant to Yellen Moore, one of his co-leaders of Lehi was Yitzhak Shamir, right? Natan Yellen Moore was the political leader of Lehi, Yisrael Eldad was the ideological leader of Lehi, and Yitzhak Shamir was the operations leader of Lehi. And when Lehi split, Shamir actually went with Yellen Moore in more of a communist direction, focusing on building a political party as opposed to a magazine, as Eldad did, and wanting to focus more on advancing what we can call the more leftist features of Lehi's identity and Lehi's program, whereas Eldad was more focused on advancing the more Jewish features of Lehi's program. But after Lehi, Shamir served in a very high position in the Mossad in Europe, and he came to politics with a lot of experience and a lot of political intelligence. And when he was prime minister in the 1980s, I think Yitzhak Shamir identified the greatest threat to Israel as being the United States pushing to divide our country, okay? Now, since the Six-Day War, the U.S. has had a consistent bipartisan foreign policy to force Israel to surrender the lands we won in that war. And for a long time, it was assumed that Israel would be pressured to return Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. But that wasn't the easiest sell, meaning I don't think that would have gained the same level of traction as the Palestinian national issue has, because forcing Israel to surrender territory to a kingdom three times its size that had been holding that territory illegally and then lost it after attacking us is a lot different than trying to force Israel to surrender that territory to a people living in that territory who don't have self-governance and don't have a clear political future or democratic representation. And so I think that the Americans figured that out, specifically George H.W. Bush, when he was vice president, I think he figured that out. And they forced the Hashemites, King Hussein, to officially relinquish Jordan's claim to the West Bank, and then made the issue the Palestinian issue. So Yitzhak Shamir identified this as the greatest threat confronting the state of Israel, and therefore declared to the world over and over and over again that we are not dividing our land, we are not giving up any territory, and we can live here peacefully with the Palestinians. Like, this is not an issue.
Just to underscore what we mean by political intelligence, when we say, compare Shamir's awareness of the U.S. and the U.S.'s role in this region, in this country, with Naftali Bennett's ignorance that when he met Biden for the first time in the White House, he said afterwards how dumbfounded he was of how steadfast Biden was about stopping settlement building, about dividing our land, how caught off guard he was. So that's really at the heart of what we mean by political intelligence, is knowing the game, knowing what the U.S. wants here, which is to divide our land. To divide our land, in the times of Shamir, was more about oil. It was more about making the Arab oil suppliers happy with the U.S. so that they would keep supplying oil. Nowadays, in a world where the U.S. is energy dependent, and where the main theaters of U.S. interests are elsewhere in Eastern Europe and in the South China Sea, their interests here are to not be involved, are to balance this region in a suspended balance between the four major powers, which are Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Iran, such that no one of those powers is more powerful, have them all kind of balancing each other out so that the U.S. doesn't have to get involved like they did in Iraq, and that they could focus on Ukraine and Russia and Eastern Europe, and they could focus on China, checking China in the South China Sea.
In such a way that they, the Americans, can maintain control over our region.
From a material perspective, from an ideological perspective, obviously, the entirety of Western civilization, of which the United States sits at the head, is about supersession. Is they recognize that at a certain point, Israel was the center of history, and we lost that. We became irrelevant, and they became the main characters of history, that they are the new Jerusalem, or as Reagan called it, that they are the Zion of the wilderness. And us returning to our land and saying, hey, you didn't supersede us because we didn't go anywhere, is a major, major philosophical challenge to the very foundations of Western civilization, to the very foundations of the United States. So both from a material perspective of not wanting Israel to disrupt this suspended, artificial calm the U.S. has created, mostly by empowering Iran and empowering Muslim Brotherhood here to balance Saudi Arabia and Israel, so that the U.S. doesn't have to get involved, doesn't have to put troops here. They can focus on other parts of the world, and also to correct this kind of what they see as a mistake in history, that we came back not just as a refugee camp on the coast, but back to Jerusalem and Hebron and Beit El and Shiloh and Shechem and our real the place that we were 2,000 years ago.
Right. So I want to reiterate something, because I don't want it to get lost. The idea that as Prime Minister, Shamir did something that we don't often think of even doing, right? He identified, this is very important, by the way, whether you're an individual in a bar fight or you're Prime Minister of a country with enemies, right? You identify primary danger, right? Like he saw the primary danger to Israel as Western attempts to take our land from us, and saw the Palestinians as the weapon that the Americans were going to use, right? Once they forced the Hashemites to relinquish their claim, then now the Palestinians are the weapon, meaning without that weapon, without the Palestinian national question, without that weapon in the hands of the Americans, there's no legitimate reason to pressure Israel to give up that land. So from Shamir's perspective, what we need to do is convince the world that we are keeping our land and the Palestinians will be just fine here with us. Now, you had a member of Knesset at that time, Rav Meir Kahana, who I don't think saw this, who I don't think understood this. He had a different background. He came from the streets of Brooklyn. He fought with Italians. You know, he fought with the Black community. He organized the Jewish Defense League. He fought for Soviet Jews. But he kept hammering over and over and over again, trying to hammer out the contradictions in Shamir's position and undermine Shamir, basically undermine the message Shamir was trying to present to the world based on Shamir's analysis of the geopolitical situation and based on what was the primary threat to Israel and based on how he could neutralize that threat. So you have Rav Kahana from the Kach party actually working to undermine the prime minister's efforts to neutralize what he considered to be the greatest threat to Israel at that time. And I think that, with all due respect, I think Rav Kahana was lacking that understanding, that analysis of the geopolitical situation that Shamir possessed. And I think that later on, we see that, you know, when it came time for the Americans to try and unseat Shamir, it was the national camp, including the national religious, who destabilized his government, who split the vote with several tiny parties. You know, there's a book by Moshe Arendt, who had been Shamir's defense minister at a time. He wrote a book called Broken Covenant about how George H.W. Bush, President George H.W. Bush, and Secretary of State James Baker interfered in Israel's political system to get Shamir out. They had conspired with Shimon Peres, who had been the leader of the Labor Party. Now, Peres lost the Labor Party primary, so they ended up with Rabin as prime minister. But this is how Shamir was unseated, largely due to the lack of political intelligence in the Israeli national camp. And by the way, this repeated itself in 1999 with President Bill Clinton basically pushing Netanyahu to do things, serious things, that definitely angered the national camp, destabilized his coalition, led to elections, and then the Americans sent James Carville and a team of American political operatives to make sure that Ehud Barak would become prime minister. And I think some of this is playing out today, because when we look at Prime Minister Netanyahu's handling of the current situation, the war, what could be a multi-front war, I think the Americans are clearly pushing Netanyahu to do several things. And as you said, Israel is currently dependent on American munitions to fight the wars we think we're going to have to fight. We haven't even begun to really fight Hezbollah, but most of Israeli society believes that we're going to have to fight Hezbollah in Lebanon after Gaza. So in a situation where Israel is currently, unfortunately, for not making the right moves previously, Israel is currently dependent on U.S. weapons to fight this war. And the U.S. is making demands of our prime minister. Some of those demands are demands that Netanyahu, I believe, for ideological reasons, cannot succumb to, like talking about a two-state solution, talking about giving the Palestinian Authority a role in Gaza, or even talking about a situation where Israel is not in control of Gaza when this war ends. Now, that being said, Netanyahu likely sees himself having to play the diplomatic game and make compromises to the U.S. on issues he considers to be less crucial, or doesn't necessarily oppose on principle. Like, for example, humanitarian aid to Gazan Palestinians. You know, that's something that I think is very easy for him to agree to, but angers a lot of people in the Ben-Gvir camp, for example. So you have somebody like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who sees himself as a student and successor to Rav Meir Kahana, actually at risk of falling into the similar trap of destabilizing Netanyahu's government in order to lead us to new elections. Because remember, the Americans know they could rely on the Israeli national camp to destabilize Likud-led governments in order to lead to elections where their guy gets in. And in this case, their guy is likely Benny Gantz. I think what the Americans would like to see in an Israeli election would be Benny Gantz becoming prime minister.
I don't know if you saw this, but Benny Gantz right now is either on his way or already in Washington on a trip meeting with senior defense officials, Vice President Harris, perhaps even President Biden. Independent of Bibi, against Bibi's wishes, Bibi has publicly come out and said that Gantz should not take this trip. So openly working with the Biden administration, with Washington, behind Bibi's back, or I guess really in front of Bibi's face, but independent of Bibi, to their own ends.
Right. Like, what's Bibi going to do about it? Right. At the end of the day, Gantz feels no pressure to do anything but what he wants and what the Americans want in this situation. So maybe we should pivot over to the topic that you are more interested in talking about, and that is these concepts of freedom. How would you lay out these different concepts of freedom and how different societies, different peoples understand the notion of freedom?
So there's an idea in political theory that different societies define their idea of freedom as a rejection of the dominant powers or paradigms of their previous historical era. So you and I are both grew up in the US, so we're very familiar with the American concept of liberty, kind of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of thought, freedom of arms, this kind of thing that we call positive freedom, freedom to, freedom of. And this is very much a rejection of like King George III and the overbearing government that was. And there's a slight difference between that and, for example, the French concept of liberté, which is more of a negative freedom, freedom from hierarchy, freedom from social norms, freedom from religion, the laïcité, the enforced secularism in French society, which is very much a rejection of the feudal system that they fought against. And it might seem small, but something like a hijab ban, which, if you don't know that, in France, you cannot enter, a woman can't enter a public school in France with hijab on. And the average American would hear that and go, oh, that's so unfree. That's so unfree. She's not hurting anybody. How could the government restrict her freedom? Versus a French person would say, what are you talking about? That's the most free thing, that you're freeing this person, you're freeing our society from the claws of organized religion, which has, you know, in the past enslaved us, justified our enslavement. Look at something even more different, like the Chinese concept of freedom, of ziyu. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but of ziyu, which is freedom of the group. That it's not this individual freedom from or freedom to, but it's freedom of the group. The idea that, as Lang Ki Chow said, men must be slaves to other men, but they must be slaves to their group. For if they are not slaves to their own group, they will assuredly be slaves to some other. And that came out of the warlord era, which was this era of chaos and anarchy in China, both between different clans, different families, and of foreign dominance. So the idea that, what is freedom? Freedom is order. Freedom is order, and freedom is independence, because it's a rejection of what was going on in the warlord era. So what does this mean for us and how we understand it in Hebrew, in our culture? There's different ways. There's Chirut, there's Dror, there's Chofshi. I think the way that's most analogous to this rejection of what came before is Geula, the idea that we came from the Galut. Therefore, our idea of freedom, of the rejection of what came before, is the Geula. It's something that really sticks out to me, is that in the Mishnah Torah and Kings and Wars, quoting from Sanhedrin, it says there will be no difference between this reality, the Galut, and the days of Mashiach, which is the Geula, except the subjugation of foreign kingdoms. That's the key difference, is that how we understand freedom is the rejection of our previous epoch, which is Galut. The characteristic of Galut is the subjugation of foreign kingdoms. And so the reversal of that, our freedom, is to be free of the foreign kingdoms. That's our understanding of freedom as a people, in the way that it rejects where we came from. In the same way that the American understanding of freedom is rejection of King George III, or the French understanding of freedom is rejection of feudalism, or the Chinese understanding of freedom is a rejection of the warlord era. Our understanding of freedom as a people, historically, and still today at root, is a rejection of the Galut, a rejection of the subjugation, our subjugation at the hands of other peoples. And that's our great challenge of today, because we're talking about Bibi today as prime minister. When Bibi entered politics in 1984, Israel was already developed a very reliant relationship on the US in terms of military dependence, which had started right after the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War was fought with Israeli soldiers counting their bullets. And we weren't receiving military shipments. We had a worldwide embargo on us, that the only country that was supplying us until that point, which was France, was participating in. So we needed the help, but at the same time, it sacrificed our operational independence at the hands of the US. our diplomatic dependence, which started during the reassessment crisis in 1974, 1975, which not so many people know about, but after the Yom Kippur War, there was immense pressure from Washington to relinquish the Sinai. And because it was so strategically important, the Rabin administration was refusing. And so the President Gerald R. Ford at the time famously said, "We are going to reassess our relationship with Israel," which eventually that scared, that it's a question, who's gonna fold first? And eventually Rabin folded and signed the Sinai Agreement, which pulled the IDF out of Western Sinai in 1975. But during the reassessment crisis is when the US started vetoing UNSC resolutions on behalf of Israel in 1974 to show that you guys need us. You guys can't afford us to reassess. You need to play ball with us. If we say give away the Sinai, give away the Sinai, and so on. And the year after Bibi entered politics was when Shimon Peres was prime minister at the time, created the U.S.-Israel Joint Economic Development Group, which was designed to address Israel's economic woes, which were quite terrible in the early 1980s, through bringing in U.S. loans. But it completely put the Israeli economy at the feet of the U.S. So when Bibi entered politics, really, there were three dimensions of subjugation to the U.S. There was the military dimension since the Six-Day War. There was the diplomatic dimension since the reassessment crisis. And there was the economic dimension since the mid-80s. And Bibi's greatest accomplishment so far in his political life has been ending Israel's economic reliance on the U.S. through his economic plan, through his privatization, the incredible economic boom, the startup nation that he has created with his economics. It hasn't come without costs, but Israel now, since about 2010, when Israel became an OECD nation, is no longer reliant on American loans like it was from 1985 until about 2010. And now because of the war, what we're seeing in the war, this real contradiction between us fighting this war with the diplomatic and military protection and supply of a country that does not share our war aims, I think is forcing Netanyahu to accelerate cutting the two dimensions that still exist, which are the military dimension and the diplomatic dimension. There's news coming out. There's a new, it's called the Blue and White program, where Bibi is starting to encourage Israeli manufacturers to manufacture war materials, weapons and such, that Israel in the future will not be dependent on the US and will have operational independence in our fighting. And also, I think after this war, we're gonna see Bibi turn towards China more, which was something that was going on previously in his leadership. Even this past summer, if you remember, when Biden was refusing to invite Bibi to the White House, Bibi scheduled meeting in Beijing, and that's what finally got Biden to fold and invite Bibi to the White House before this war started. So I think that will definitely accelerate. And it's hard to think about now because China has been supplying Iran, has been supplying Hamas, or finding a lot of Chinese weapons in Gaza. And of course, Chinese diplomats have been saying a lot of very, frankly, very offensive things during this war, very hurtful things. But we need to remember that in the international system, it's a system governed by interests, and interests could change depending on the alignment of different powers. So I think that's definitely something to look out for going forward, is Bibi opening up more to China, not necessarily doing what Netanyahu more did and advocating a move strongly into the Soviet bloc, being more open to both sides, kind of like Nasser was in the 50s, being open to both sides and trying to get the best support from both sides of this new Cold War. And also for us to develop our own weapons, to be supplying our own weapons, manufacturing our own weapons, so that we have operational independence in a war, so that we're fighting a war for our own interests and for our own goals and not for another country's goals.
It's well said. And as you said, I think that a sternest argument can be made for a pivot to China, for Israel to try to join the BRICS nations. That's a longer conversation, and maybe we'll have that one day. You know, I'm sorry that we're not able to disclose your name, or that you're not interested in disclosing your name, because I think you should get credit for your ideas and your analysis from our listeners. But I'm glad that our listeners are able to hear the type of analysis that is common within the vision movement. There are obviously different perspectives within our movement, and people come to different political conclusions on a variety of issues. But I think that just listening to you put forward your understanding of what's going on and what it could mean and what our options are and what our prime minister might be thinking is very expressive of the type of thinking that exists here at Vision.
Yeah, I don't see BB joining the China bloc entirely, even if I thought that was a good thing, which I waver on, because he really does see himself as a Western politician.
No, BB Netanyahu is in, I believe that he is an ideological revisionist Zionist. I don't think Netanyahu is a Sternist. He's a revisionist Zionist. He is a Zionist.
Definitely, yeah, I definitely agree with that.
And I think he is behaving as a revisionist Zionist in many ways. And we should analyze his behavior and expect him to make the moves that a revisionist Zionist would make according to the teachings of Ze'ev Jabotinsky.
Yeah, look, I think there's a teaching that Yiftach and Shimshon were for their generation what Shmuel was for his. And at face value, that's a very strange thing, because Yiftach and Shimshon are very flawed characters in the Tanakh. And Shmuel is one of the few characters where there's really not even a bad word, a questioning word said about him in his two books in the Tanakh. So what that teaches us is that we always have the leadership that we need at any given time. And it's not always going to look like King David or Moses or sometimes it's going to look like Yiftach. Sometimes it's going to look like Shimshon. And that's okay, because that's what we're always going to have what we need at the time. The pieces are there. And we're going to see if the execution is there too.
All right, we'll see. So I'd like to thank our anonymous soldier for joining us on the show, and wish you success, and Hashem should watch over you during your military service.
Thank you. Hopefully the next show will be under my name.
And if listeners are interested in supporting our program, I urge you to go to patreon.com/visionmovement. where you can join our Patreon community at whatever tier is most reasonable to you. And of course, based on the tier that you join at, you would have access to certain exclusive content and other benefits like the swag that we sent out, discounts on our retreats. For those of you who are interested in attending our retreat this coming Shabbat, I know it's late notice because this is airing pretty close to Shabbat, but we are having a retreat in the Miami area. And anybody who's interested in coming, if you are a Patreon member at a certain tier, you would be entitled to a discount on that. But even those who are not in a position to support us at Patreon financially can do a lot to help us get our messages out and get this type of analysis out. Just give us a good rating on whatever platform you like to listen to podcasts at. Give us a good rating, a good review, and share it with your friends. And that in and of itself does a lot to help us grow and to help our message spread. So once again, thank you to our Patreon community and to those who share and like and leave positive reviews to help us in our work. And thank you to our anonymous soldier for coming on the show and discussing these issues with me in the merit of Nathan Yellen Moore's memory and legacy. And if listeners are interested in checking out the show notes to this podcast, you can go to visionmag.org/thenextstage117.